CliffCentral.com.
Welcome to Leadership Transformation Platform, multiplying authentic leaders, moving society. Absolutely wonderful, wonderful to be with you. For all things leadership, go to leadershipplatform.com. One word, two P's in the middle. Of course, this is our weekly leadership masterclass. We love interviewing leaders, having very important conversations. Everything in life revolves around leadership, and that's why this leadership masterclass is so important. Today we talk about best practice as far as executive leadership development is concerned. So it's not for the broader audience. We'll touch on more junior leadership development as well, but we have a very challenging world, and we have a lot of executives all over the world who are involved in this. With us to discuss it and in a way unpack it, we have very experienced HR execs, or people that have functioned in that field or are still functioning, and they're going to help us understand it. We've got Thebile Zulu from Mondelez International in South Africa and also part of Africa. It's a snacking company. And Thebile, remind us, what chocolate?
Cadbury. Cadbury.
Okay, so, I mean, it sort of comes from that direction.
Yes.
The brands, it's biscuits and all snacks and things. So it's on the top 500 NASDAQ, is it? Companies, it's huge, it's global.
Yeah.
So, and you've just been brought into this part of the world to make a difference. So welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thank you, Adrian.
And then no stranger to our show and Cliff Central and media in general, Professor Shirley Zinn, who served at the top of HR in Nedbank, in Standard Bank, very involved also of late at Woolworths and other places. So she has seen executive leadership development programs run for many, many years and can no doubt add a lot of value. Shirley, welcome.
Thank you very much, Adrian.
And thank you for availing yourself last minute. The other HR exec we had to cancel this morning. So for you standing in, we recognize that. We appreciate it immensely. All right, millions, perhaps billions all over the world are spent on executive leadership development. I don't know if anyone has a figure, if anyone knows what that spend is, but I'm guessing it must be all over the world now. It must be billions, because they are usually super expensive. The question is it paying off? Are we succeeding as a society when it comes to this? So before we go there, ladies, both of you are very experienced leaders in your own right, and certainly in the HR field to a large degree. Thebile, you've seen executive leadership development programs run.
Yes.
You've initiated them. You've sourced people. You've seen it work or not work, no doubt. Am I right? You have seen it, obviously on all levels, but that's what we're talking about today.
Yes, I've seen quite a few leadership development programs launched, one for one of the companies that I've worked for, and most certainly recently worked on leadership development for the Africa and Middle East region in the previous company that I worked for.
Okay, so that's also relevant on our continent,
yes.
You know, which is a unique continent, maybe.
Most definitely.
Yeah, although there would be similarities with the rest of the world. Shirley, you've also seen them play out over and over and over again.
That is correct, Adrian. I've seen and been involved in sourcing, in developments, in customization of on-the-shop programs, working on different methodologies for delivery. And I've seen the transition of leadership development programs over the years, and in terms of it trying to stay relevant and responsive to some of the key challenges and paradoxes we face in our society today.
Okay.
And you're absolutely correct. Organizations, especially some of the large ones that I've worked in, have spent hundreds of millions of rands on leadership development. And the very important question that one is left with is to ask, what has been the return on the investment?
Yeah.
What has been the impact? What difference has all of this made?
So I'm going to make a statement and say collectively speaking, the world is in a mess. I'm not speaking individually, and there are pockets of excellence. And I'm talking economically, politically. And therefore, the question is, has leadership development been successful? Because leaders lead us towards crisis, or they lead us away from it, or through it. So if we say economically for 7, 8, 9 years, pretty much since the banking world crashed, except for South Africa, I don't know. We can argue that it's your Harvard MBAs and your Oxford MBAs and many others that have been trained very well, no doubt, on leadership. Yet the world remains in a collective crisis. So collectively speaking, I'm not talking your organizations now. Have we failed, actually? Kabile, what do you think?
You know, speaking from a South Africa and probably an African perspective, I would say that we have a lot of catching up to do with the rest of the world. I mean, you mentioned the Oxfords, the Harvards, and when you look at their programs and you look at what our institutions and what our companies are actually offering at the moment, it's not yet comparable with the rest of the world. You still see quite a lot of focus on your general management focused leadership development programs. We call them leadership development programs, but when you look at the content, it's typically financial management, operations management,
strategies,
technically and functional skills focused programs. We're not yet seeing programs that are focused on more of the difficult to touch aspects of leadership, things like innovation, adaptability, because you know you speak about all of the economic complexities that we're seeing and the speed at which things are changing in the world. I don't think that as a continent we've gotten to a point where we understand what type of leadership competencies we need to be developing in order for us to catch up.
Okay, we're going to dig into that a little bit more. But in essence, you're saying we've got catching up to do, so I can read between the lines that we, I know I'm saying it dramatically, we failed collectively. Shirley, add to that for us.
So, Erin, if you wanted to know what is the purpose of leadership development, you know, what are the objectives that we are looking for? And I think the answer has to be we want to grow and develop purposeful, meaningful, inspirational, transformational, ethical leaders who understand the complexity of the shifting markets, the impact of technology, and want and have not only the hard skills, which used to be very fashionable and I think is absolutely a given. You know, you need to be financially astute, you need to have marketing skills, you need to have all of that. And that we say is a given. The new world of work and the new kind of emerging leader that we would like to see in the world really needs to present us with something quite different. And, you know, if we say that those trends are converging around, you know, are our leaders today able to develop and communicate and connect with their people with a compelling vision, able to engage people in an authentic, meaningful way, have the necessary critical skills and cognitive capability to make good decisions, to problem solve, to be creative. If we have to ask these questions, you know, how many of our programs that we have invested so much in actually takes people through some kind of self-reflection and introspection on who they are in the world, what their purpose is, why they believe that they are leaders, and what difference that it is that they are making to the world, what are their values, what are their visions. I don't think that there's sufficient reflection. I don't think that that these programs have been built around these kind of core elements of development that are, you know, deeply personal often. And I think that if we don't start to develop you know, and it's not only the programs, I mean, it's also around, you know, role models and mentoring and coaching. What are people actually seeing out there? What are people hearing? What are people, you know, buying into in terms of what they believe in terms of good values, of respect for other people, of humility, of service, of making a difference to the world.
Heck of a lot.
And I don't think that we are you know, focusing on that is sufficiently well, and hence the problem we have of the mess that you've just referred to in your opening statement.
So I think you started touching on what components the ideal executive leadership development program should have. So as we unpack that, we may need to come back with some of that. But I got it. Louis, you took some notes. Just if we can take a minute and just look at how it's evolved. So over the years, how has executive leadership development evolved? I mean, did it start many years ago with classroom style? And then what did the world cotton onto? And how is there a clear evolution of how it happened and then where we are today? Kabile, have you seen anything? And Shirley and Louis, come in any time. I'm sure it has evolved in some way. We must surely have become more sophisticated in our understanding of these things. Kabile?
Adrian, it definitely has evolved. I think maybe Shirley will give a perspective from maybe 10, 15 years ago. But looking at what has been happening in probably the last 5 to 10 years, in that time frame, we've seen leadership development programs moving away from typically being in a classroom, business school environment, where companies are moving more to customizing and adapting it to what they need, what their challenges are. So it's moving a lot more in-house. But there's also been a shift in terms of technology, because we're not delivering these programs for single geographical areas anymore. So you look at the virtual classroom. And I think South Africa has a long way to go in terms of catching on to that, where it's no longer a classroom approach, but it's online. It's technology based. So if you are not moving towards that, I think whatever that you are delivering might probably be obsolete, because you haven't really caught on to what is happening in the rest of the world. So that's the evolution that I can talk about. So there's much more collaboration between different business schools in different countries, cross borders, cross companies. When I was in the Netherlands, there is something that happens between companies where companies are not afraid to actually share the resources in terms of how they develop their leaders. So you see a lot more executives coming from a different business to come and talk to executives in another business about how they've overcome their challenges. So sharing their experiences. So that is something that I saw that was quite shifting for me, because I think we still operate from a mindset of saying it's competition. We compete for talent. So to get an executive from a competitor to come and talk to my organization about how they've overcome their challenges from a leadership point of view, it's something that I think we need to seriously start looking at, because the problems we face are generally the same. And if we can learn from each other, I think it solves a few problems that we currently face.
I think we talk of authentic leadership. That's an authentic leadership attitude, is to go beyond boundaries. Yeah, we compete on one field, but we collaborate on another. And often we collaborate on big social issues and just to make sure our society survives for the future generations. Just a word quickly, Shirley, on the evolution of executive leadership development before we start looking at how we do this.
Thank you, Adrian. So just on the evolution of leadership development, before, and I'm talking maybe 10, 20 years ago, it was something that, leadership, you would go on a very expensive program, and you'd be, you'd be out in a very, expensive kind of hotel, and, with all the frills that go with it, and it would be, a break from the workplace. You could afford to stay away for a few weeks, put bums on seats, do a little bit of, actually mostly theory, and a little bit of practice mixed with it, and that essentially was, the way leadership development generally happened. What people actually then did when they came back, and the implementation and the actioning of the learnings, and then the impact on the business wasn't very actively measured, and essentially people just came back and didn't really change too many any of their behavior or any of their ways of doing things in the workplace. I think, business schools really had to adapt, to what are the new market conditions, what does the new economy require of us, what are the trends that influence traditional program models, and methodologies of teaching. And I think you know, in 2008 also there's been, after the global meltdown, a lot of kind of belt tightening, you know, leading to cuts in these things. And so many employees actually are now investing in their own learning. So they, you know, they are self-sponsoring and going to select specific programs that they believe will, you know, speak to their own personal development. And I think that, you know, some of the key trends are around, you know, enhanced cultural awareness. We talked about global and operating across geopolitical boundaries. I think this is something that a lot of business schools are still trying to grapple with. And then also, you know, new offerings emerging based on people's schedules and you know, the fact that you can't sit in a classroom for months on end and come back and really not add any value. So what, you know, really having to rethink what is in that curriculum. Content now is everywhere. People can go on Google and find out what they need to do. The idea is of putting people together is about, you know, how you can learn from your peers in a classroom or virtually even, or in a project, or from your competitors from experts in the field. And there's a lot more work going on also around, you know, as we evolve into coaching and mentoring. But I think the whole thing is that you cannot have a leadership development program that was applicable in the industrial age and try to now apply it to post-industrial age needs or industrial revolution, okay, if you want to put it that way.
All right. So that gives us a really good feel, and it makes sense to me, more accountability coming back into the picture. But a thought that came to me also, Louis, and all of you, your views on this, I get a feeling, and even today, but certainly in the past, that a leader needs development, so we send the leader on leadership development program for the now. So when you come back, you must be a better leader. It wasn't necessarily a case of let's scan the environment and see where the world is going, and then prepare a program that will equip the leader not just for the now, but what's coming. And what's coming these days is coming faster and faster. So that ability to train the leader not just for the now, but for the future. Louis, your comments?
Surely I appreciate your summary of these subjects we come across all the time, and each one stands on their own feet, including the technology catch-up. But the one thing I feel very strongly about, I've just finished sitting 2 days with 14 leaders in a very practical environment, and what keeps on coming back to me with all the years of involvement with leadership development is the fact that, Shirley, you mentioned about the need to try and sell the core values, you know, the people. I find more and more that people respond to who you are. So I'm not sure if all the trainers, whether they're executives or consultants, if they reflect the inner core values themselves, have they walked the cult of life like Shirley has and like some of us have. So I find that people respond warmly if you really can relate to real experience out there and you've gone through the pain curves. You mentioned about getting competitors in and things like that. So that, I think, is a great lack. So you can't separate, if you train or try to be example of these things, you can't separate your own mastery of the core values.
So in other words, the professors, the lecturers, the consultants, the whoever involved. Kabele, you want to comment on that? And also on the fact that we train people to be a better, they must come back now and be a better leader. But you know what, a year from now, maybe it's not that valuable anymore. They then need to perform. Thoughts?
I think that's absolutely key, what you're talking about now, Adrian, around we train for the now and not for the future. And without going too much into a lot of details, I think we should just look at some of the corporate failures in recent years and the companies that have, you know, lost the market share, that have gone out of business simply because they focused on the now and not, you know, what's going to happen in the future. I mean, if you look at companies in the cell phone industry, you look at, you know, Nokia, and then you look at Apple. You know, what differentiates Apple from Nokia? What differentiates Facebook, for instance, from the rest of the organization? I think it's the visioning, what the future is going to look like, and then developing your people and giving them the right kind of competencies for them to navigate the kind of volatility that you see currently. So if the vision is clear, I think it's much more easier to train people and to give them the right tools for them to help the business get to what the future is going to look like. But if we spend our time just simply looking at what is happening now and not thinking, okay, hang on a second, let's reflect, let's see what's going to change, what's coming, what are some of the trends that we see in the market, I think we you know, businesses will suffer the same fate as some of the corporate failures that we've seen. I think to build on what you've just mentioned around the self-awareness, the something that you know, we call learning agility, mm-hmm. or leadership agility. I think for me, the most important thing that we need to be doing as businesses is helping our leaders understand who they are, what are their capabilities, what kind of DNA do they have, and how can they also build on that? Because, you know, development is not the responsibility of the organization only. You know, as an individual, you also have to know what are your capabilities, what are your competencies, what are your values, what do you believe in, why are you where you are now, and what difference do you want to make in the space that you've been entrusted with. And if we can help to develop the whole spectrum of learning agility, which is just self-awareness, mental agility. Shirley spoke about, you know, cognitive focus when it comes to developing our leaders. Mm. People agility, you know, how well do you collaborate with other people? Because the world is now not only about what is happening in South Africa, but how do you work with your colleagues who are in Singapore who have different values to the ones that you have as an African? So I think if we can start working on those things, which most people think are soft skills, but I think that's actually the hard part. You know,
that's the real part.
Becoming an excellent operations manager is something that most people can do, but becoming an authentic leader, somebody who's mm-hmm. quite in tune with the inside and how you treat people, how you work with others, how you respect other people's cultures, for me, that's what actually makes a difference.
And that's where we get to that I'm not being facetious or funny, Shirley, that endless list you mentioned just now of all the attributes and the qualities and the themes and the topics that should come into a program. You want to comment on Kabile and Louise's inputs there? Some brilliant ones.
Yeah, thank you, Aideen. You know, I just want to say one word before I comment on that about the kind of offerings that are currently out there. So there are a lot of business schools across the world who are offering all kinds of programs, you know, into, you know, trying to respond to this leadership development question that we are grappling with. Many of them are, you know, kind of missing the boat largely. And I think that there are some other players coming in, like, you know, the huge consulting firms, the big ones are also now in the process, you know, in play in terms of in the competitive landscape of leadership development programs. And I think that, you know, they really need to listen very carefully to, you know, what is going on the ground in terms of the changes we've been talking about. There are huge economic, political, social, environmental changes. And you know, what we really have to say is that we need a new set of values for leaders. We need business educators who can improve, you know, and inspire future innovation, focusing on people, making significant contributions to society. And I think that this whole thing that I, you know, always talk about, humanization of our businesses, human-centered innovations, serving a higher purpose, I think is something that, you know, is really mandatory in terms of a compelling purpose. And profits will follow this, I do believe. So there needs to be a much bigger focus in terms of changing the curriculum, changing the way people learn, getting people to grapple and build this self-awareness as well that Tabila was talking about. I think this is very, very important. And I think if we continue to do what we're doing today, we're going to continue to dig this leadership hole that we find ourselves in and continue to produce the kind of people that think that they are running good organizations because they're making great profits for today. They're not understanding the impact in society for the future. And I think this is where if it's need to learn.
We are expecting a lot of our executive leaders. I mean, in South Africa, you see the role that corporate plays, probably picking up a lot of the pieces from political mistakes and weak leadership there, perhaps, where leadership development is often not that formal. But in corporate environment, you have a lot of investment in formal leadership development and some of the best in the world. So you see some of those leaders. I see in the mining industry where I spend a lot of time, where the leadership is extending into communities, local communities. Some of it pushed by government, absolutely, you know, holding them accountable to make things happen and to become part of the solution. But how do we, can we just practically look at how do you structure, Tibile, what's the best, I don't know, structure of an executive leadership development program? I guess there's a component of maybe theory, although by that time, these men and women have been through so many, some of them have MBAs, some of them are engineers or lawyers or whatever already. They have practically functioned in marketing and sales and finance. And so when they get to that point, classroom type stuff is not necessarily what they need. Also, they can't do it without their phones on and their laptops because they can't be away from the office. All those things we mentioned. So how have you seen and what part does coaching play, for example, where it becomes individual and deep? So how do you structure? How do you see an executive? And also, again, when you do it every couple of months, 2 days, flat out, how do you become leadership fit? You know, I can't become running fit by doing a marathon every second month. So can you give us some thoughts on the shall we say, ideal structure for a program like that? And then Shirley, you can also come in. Let's just get a bit practical. Then I'll come back to a few philosophical points.
Well, Adrian, the question you've just asked now is not an easy one to answer, because in my experience, there is no perfect or perfect structure or perfect model. I think each organization has to look at what works, what are their current challenges that they're facing, and then build around that. Because for some companies that have the resources, they would, you know, outsource everything to a business school and say, run with it, provide the coaches, provide the mentors for us. But companies, you know, are tightening their belts, as Shirley was mentioning earlier. So sometimes it's not possible to just outsource, you know, everything. So in an ideal world, if you had all of the money, I think you can really come up with a nice, fancy leadership development program. But in my own experience, if you cannot find, you know, ready-made people, you know, then you have to think about how do you build, how do you grow your own timber, how do you build what you already have and give people the necessary tools. There's still a place for classroom training, definitely, because you need that human interaction. I don't think there's anything that can ever replace that. So when you're sitting in a classroom and you have people that you can talk to, that you can listen to them, share their stories.
Conversations happen.
Conversations, yes, exactly. Mm. So most companies will have a generic learning philosophy, which is a 70-20-10. You know, if I were to give somebody advice and say, as a bare minimum, look at your approach and see that 10% or roundabout there comes from classroom and interactions of that nature. 20% then is the relationships that people need to have in order to learn and grow. So we talk about mentorship, we talk about coaching, but we also talk about professional networks. I think some of people that I've met, they underestimate the importance of going to a networking function for CAs, you know, if it's CAs or it's a leadership development workshop, where you get to meet other people and you get to learn from other people's experiences. So that will form part of your 20%. But learning happens, in my own view, mostly by doing. So give people the experiences, the on-the-job experiences that give them that kind of exposure. For example, I mean, I work for a multinational, and some of the things that happen to give people that kind of experience is that people get placed in cross-cultural teams, for instance, whether virtually or physically, and they get to work on projects where they get to practice and they get to learn about leading others. They get to learn about leading across cultures. They learn to they get to learn about leading across borders, because that all has its own challenges. So I would have a blended approach. It wouldn't be I would caution corporates from just relying on a business school program and thinking that actually delivers. I think the one last thing that I would want to say on how you approach your leadership development strategy is that use the leaders that you have in the organization. I think we underestimate the power of the internal network. So in an organization, you have people that embody the values of your business, people that you look at and you say, that's typically the type of leadership brand that we want to have in our organization. Mm. You know, previous experience, companies would use those leaders to come and deliver some of the content that you might have developed for your leadership development program. They become coaches to your staff. They become mentors to your staff. You transfer that kind of leadership brand and those values by using the very same leaders that you have in the organization.
Yeah.
Some people might argue that, well, you might end up recycling, you know,
same thinking,
the same kind of thinking, but I would say blend it. It's not the only thing that you should do. You have to come at this from different angles. But if you've got good leaders that embody what you want as an organization, use those people.
Multiply it.
Exactly.
But it's fascinating. And Shirley, I want to hear your views on the kind of structure that one can use. That was a good guideline there. The challenge is you can have an executive team of 8 or 10 individuals, or maybe a broader one, up to 20, whatever it may be. And still, it's a very individual journey. So somehow it's got to become very individualized. You can't have a blanket approach at that level. And also they have to take some responsibility themselves. But then you have a company culture or a leadership framework that you've worked out, the leadership brand that you that you want for your business. So blending those two, not an easy thing to do. Shirley, some comments on the ideal sort of structure?
So Adrian, I agree with everything that Fabrizio has been saying. And I think that we really need to think really carefully about how we, package learning. So before it used to be largely kind of, bums on seats in classrooms. And I agree that there's always, place for the classroom because it's an opportunity to facilitate courageous discussions between people, put experts in front of people, get people to work together on case studies, get people to do critical analysis in their cohorts, in the evenings. The case study methodology is a very popular one from the Harvard Business School in particular. But I think, moving into the future, notwithstanding all the things that we've done in the past that might or might not have been effective or sufficiently effective, I think that we now have, all this disruptive innovation and, it's changing how we learn and what we learn and when we learn. So I think just-in-time learning is very important. So being able to access a module somewhere that is relevant for your particular issue right now that you need to be dealing with. So if people, need some deep insight on something that, they can access that. Obviously, there's virtual and online education that is becoming, quite a big element of the offerings even in our own tertiary institutions today. I think that experiential learning, as Tabitha was saying, experiential learning on the job, doing live projects is something the way people really and truly learn, to make a difference. And I think your point about individualized learning, so yes, it can be personalized depending on what the issue is. So the diagnostics, that we do ahead of time to determine what exactly is the solution for individual people and for teams. And I think there's a case to be made as well for team learning, for team education, for how do we work together more effectively, how do we understand each other, how do we play to each other's strengths, how do we have these courageous conversations amongst ourselves and to create opportunities for that to happen as well.
Mm.
And then you have things like, incubators and business networks and professional networks, as Tabitha was saying. And in my world, in HR, I think the professional networks were quite important in terms of your brand visibility and contributing to the professional, to the profession, making a difference to the profession and influencing and shaping the way the profession moves. And I think there are lots of in-company projects, there are conferences, there are interactions with alums, and a whole lot of, seminars, cocktails and things that can be attended. So I think we must be more open-minded in terms of how we actually determine what is the correct, choice for a particular leader to go on, because it's not going to be a one size fit all. But I do want to say that there's the individual component, and then there's the team element that we mustn't underestimate as well.
Yeah, interesting point there, bringing in the team element. It sounds very complex, doesn't it? It sounds to me sometimes like we are picking up the pieces and overcompensating and overinvesting because we were not willing in corporates to invest enough when those leaders were young trees, when they were young supervisors, young managers. But there are more of them in the business, you see. So now you have to actually spend more money because you've got a population of 200 while your executives are 10. So we end up having to work much harder to bend that old tree straight, whereas we could have influenced them earlier on. But it's a budgetary thing very often. And that concerns me a little bit. Kabile, you're shaking your head as if you agree. I think there's a gap there, and it's a problem, I think.
I absolutely agree. I think we often make the mistake of when we bring in fresh and young talent into an organization, we get them very much focused on the functional competence type of programs, which is well and good. But we don't introduce the concept of leadership from a very young age. And I mean, there's many ways of doing it, but here we're talking specifically within the corporate environment. So I think when people come in, those conversations need to be had with those individuals that this is what the world of work looks like, and this is the type of leadership values that we have as a business. Start the conversation from when people join your business, and not just restrict them into being marketing graduates or finance graduates, which is typically what happens. And when somebody then gets into first line management, then we scurry and try and then introduce the concept of leadership. For me, leadership should not really be something that we talk about with leaders that have, you know, direct reports or people reporting to them. I mean, anyone in an organization can be, is a leader, in fact, in your own space. You don't have to have people reporting to you to be regarded as a leader. And I think that's what corporates tend to do. We say, well, now you have people reporting to you, therefore you are a leader.
Yeah.
And we forget that you can be carrying a toolbox and an artisan, but you are a leader in that particular space. You have to coordinate your operators. I mean, I'm taking it right to the basics. You have to coordinate maintenance with operators that don't report to you. So we should move away from that kind of thinking that a leader is somebody who has people reporting to them. And this is why then, you know, to your point, you see companies now starting to, you know, make these type of investments because we've neglected people when they are at lower levels in the organization.
We pay a big price because it starts at the family where parents are maybe too busy and they don't develop their kids to be better leaders. I mean, to me, it's the first school of leadership is the family. Then they go to school and we know that's where we should really give them leadership development. But
yeah.
I mean, there's no money there to pay expensive consultants and whoever. So it just filters up all the way until the person gets to the very top, and then we spend millions to try and turn them around. Louis, some quick comments?
I'm thinking, Adrian, of the concept of starting young. We've successfully stressed the principle of seeing leadership as your first profession. So the sooner you drop the fact that you're not an accountant anymore or an engineer, you actually become a leader. So the concept of leadership is a priority which serves your other profession, but should be the first profession.
So your first profession is leadership in that sense. And we say that best part inside of you, that's the leadership part.
True.
Very often, if you think about it, when you talk, that's leadership. When you listen, that's leadership. When you communicate, that's leadership. When you convince, that's leadership. When you persuade, that's leadership. When you confront, and so in the end, we're all applying leadership all the time. Right now we are. We're convincing each other. We're communicating. But we do associate it with title, and that's a bit sad. If we can, something that's definitely stuck its head out of late and become a very strong tool is this executive leadership coaching component. But I want to bracket that in there with leadership development in general. And if you allow me just a minute, more and more I'm realizing also, Shirley, that what happens is leaders go on a leadership development program off the playing field.
Mm.
Or their coaching even happens off the playing field. in an office or at a restaurant or wherever. And a lot of good conversation happens there, a lot of self-discovery maybe even, a lot of interesting things happen. But then the leader who's being coached or trained goes back into the work environment, leads like crazy, comes back to the full circle to the trainer or the coach or the whoever, and gives feedback, very, very subjective feedback of how I think I'm doing. Yeah, I went and did what we discussed in the coaching session last week, Adrian, and man, it went off so well until I maybe speak to the employees or to the boss, and you find out, gee, was this individual. So it's a bit like bringing in the best coach or training staff for the Blue Bulls and training them like crazy off the field. But those people who do the training never go and watch them play games, are never on the field with them, never give them feedback during halftime, do an analysis afterwards, and then give feedback and say, let's look at this video exactly there. You see what you did there? You could have passed, but you were selfish. You wanted the limelight, and you tried to take the gap, and you didn't, and we lost because of that, or whatever. Imagine doing off-field coaching for a sporting team or a sporting person. I coach Federer, but I never see him play. I never sit next to the field like we see with these coaches. Man, their faces are as famous as the players because they are always there. So do you see where I'm coming from in terms of training on and off the field, coaching on and off the field? I think there's a weakness in the coaching industry, for example. They depend on the and then last point I want to say is, Shirley, you're a prof even, but I bet you if you have to write a document and go through it meticulously and edit it and look for mistakes, you might think I've got it all. Then you give it to me, even who's not a doctorate or a PhD. I might find a mistake. I'll probably find a typographical error or something that you can improve. We cannot evaluate our own documents. So how the heck do we evaluate our own behavior and come back to my coach and say, I think I'm behaving brilliantly at the moment. I think my people love me. Are you with me, Shirley?
Yeah, I think that's a huge point that you make there. And it's a little bit of a paradox of coaching and mentoring. And I want to go back to the point that we talked about earlier, is that, you know, we all are called upon to lead from where we are. We are leaders, not in title and in status always. So we've got to actually start from a much, much earlier age in terms of this kind of development. Maybe we can call it something else if we like, but you know, we need to nurture leadership capability from a very early age. And as Tabilia was saying, you know, sometimes, you know, we get leadership and management mixed up. So we, you know, and management is very different from leadership. And we think that because people have functional skills and competencies that they, in the top echelons of the organization, they can be called leaders. But probably not, you know. So I think we must sort out a nomenclature on that. That's one of the things we need to think about. But in your coaching and mentoring off the playing field and on the playing field point that you make, I can't agree with you more because I'm spending quite a lot of time listening to people who ask me to be a mentor or be a coach, and I'm finding that somehow there's an evolution even happening in that space now. So what people are asking me to do actually is just to, can I soundboard my strategy with you? Can you be a trusted advisor to me and keep this confidential, because I'm trying to find a very complicated, I'm trying to resolve a very complex, strategic solution. And, I can't speak to anybody else. There's no one to soundboard with, no one to talk to, no one to test things with or validate things with. And so that's one sort of element of it. I find that people are asking for more and more. And then there's still this old traditional approach to, you come for an hour a month and you expect your behavior to change, and you sit in my office for an hour and, you know, it just isn't going to shift things significantly. So I do think that we need to challenge the coaching and mentoring community to start thinking really differently about how they are developing our leaders.
Kabile, and then Louis.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's an important point that you raised, Adrian. This is why some companies really use internal coaches. When they launch a coaching program, they train people within the company because then they can almost do the coaching on the field. But if you do use an external coach, I think there's a sense of vulnerability that we need to get to as leaders, where we are comfortable with ourselves and we are not scared that if I brought an outsider to come and look at how I interact with people, how I lead the team that I have, then, you know, it doesn't show me up as a, it doesn't show up my weaknesses to somebody else. So in as much as yes, it's a good thing to do, but I think you need to have someone who's very comfortable in who they are, who's also self-aware, who knows exactly what they need and why they are on this coaching journey. So that when somebody comes from outside, I'm not then suddenly worried, you know, is my team going to think I'm incompetent? Why do I have a coach? Why do I have someone coming in to observe and give me that kind of feedback? But when you are at a level of, you know, consciousness where you know exactly what it is that leadership is about, then that would not be a problem to have somebody coming from outside. But lastly, if you can't do that, then get feedback from your people. Get them to give you feedback that you can actually take to your coach rather than your own subjective, as you put it, kind of assessment of how well you're doing.
Correct. We know there's big challenges if you're a heavyweight executive and you've got internal coaches. For that person who is usually more junior to come and sit in front of that person and say the tough things or reflect it. So there's pros and cons for that. Louis, comment, and then I want to share something quickly.
Thank you. Some valuable points are coming out here. Powerful. I just want to mention that the level of trust is very important if you expect to be able to change. So I wouldn't change if I don't trust the person that's mentoring me. The point, though, is it's a time constraint because people sell time. But at the same time, can you really trust a coach that doesn't feel at home in your working environment? Now, it doesn't have to be an expert in a specific environment, but he should be an expert in the principles involved that drives confidence and able to, universal principles and values, etc. So I would be very wary of a coach that is avoiding the practical situation because it shows he's not at home there.
So let me quickly tell you, for interest's sake, my week. I had a conversation with an executive team of a major listed mining company and started this week working with them. Okay, but here's how it starts. There are one-on-ones, but the week kicked off with a morning executive meeting in which I sat as an extended member of the executive, watching the dynamics and the people on the field. Then they moved to another part of the country where they listened to budget presentations from mine to mine to mine. I sat in a lot of that. But in the process, called them out one by one and did the hour, shall we say, one-on-one session. Now I see this person functioning in the executive team as well as when his or her team comes in to present budget and it's being interrogated, go back into a one-on-one session, and suddenly I cannot explain the value of seeing leaders on the field and then sitting in the one-on-one session. Then you see the disconnect. The leader would, in the one-on-one session, say how amazing he or she functions out there, but you see the leader in the meeting saying not a word. And you go, hold on, something, there's a disconnect. So the ability to find a way to see, and this is how it was explained. You know, you look at a top soccer team of a country, surely, or the top rugby team, guess what? You've got the best players in the country playing for that team. Do they have a coach? Flip, they have a coaching staff, man, and they are coached every day of their lives for once a week game. Then you have top executives in companies like yourself, Kabile. I mean, they play the game every day, and they are also at the top of their game. But why don't they have enough coaching or enough input on and off the field? So when you start comparing little metaphors like that, then you realize, hold on, we missed something. You can make yourself vulnerable. Do you really think, who's your favorite top sports person, this and this person? Does that person have a coach? Yes. So why shouldn't you have one? What makes you so wonderful that you can't be vulnerable enough to make yourself better? True. Shirley, quick, how much time do we have left? Kevin, give me a signal there. I think I'm getting carried away. Okay. So we have to wrap up. We've got about 5 minutes just to look at things. Any comments on what I just said, which is personal experience? The difference it's making for me to not go just off the field, Shirley.
Yeah, no, I think it's a very powerful point, and I think there's still a view in corporate South Africa in particular that, you know, if I'm allocated, if there's a piece of feedback that says I need some sort of development, firstly, and secondly, perhaps I need some coaching, that people actually still, you know, feel a bit offended by, you know, the fact that they might need coaching and they haven't quite arrived. And they don't see it as, you know, here's an opportunity to grow and to thrive and to improve, you know, on my strengths as a leader. And so people come into coaching, you know, relationships often with, you know, I'm not sure why I'm here and I'm not sure what I have to learn. Mm. And so you have a little bit of, you know, that kind of situation evolving as well. But I think Adrian, you make a very, very good point about the fact that if you compare to the sporting analogy, your very best sport people, you know, they do know that this is something very important in their lives. And I think it's something that we need to translate into something meaningful in the business space as well. I think just in closing, Adrian, for me, I think that we in our world in general have a trust deficit right now. We have a leadership crisis, I think, on our hands here, and I'm really quite concerned that, you know, we need to ensure that we are investing in and growing a healthy pipeline of leadership leaders, you know, that are going to take us into a meaningful and compelling future. And I think that one of the big things that we do need to work on is how do we inspire confidence and support and enable, you know, good leadership and rebuild the trust that it's currently in a shambles, in my view, in terms of the leaders that we currently have around us.
Shirley, thank you so much. We'll from your side, we'll leave it at that. We appreciate the privilege of chatting with you all the way from Cape Town, and for all the valuable input you gave. And then we'll get Thabile to just close down, give us some final thoughts, and Louis as well. We'll wrap it up on this side. Appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Bye-bye, Shirley. So that's Shirley, Professor Shirley Zinn, who's a very experienced HR exec, and more than that, she's actually quite prominent in the country. Author, and her book is so successful. So it's so wonderful to have her set aside time at the last minute. Thabile, pull it together. A lot of things said. When all is said, nothing is done. But what do we take away from this conversation for our leaders? If someone listened to the last 5 minutes now or the last 3 minutes, what do we want them to walk away with?
And there's so much to say and so little time. I think I just want to touch on the one last thing that you talked about, which is around coaching. And I advocate a lot of coaching to the people that I work with. And you are right. People don't see it as, you know, In the analogy that you gave of a top performing soccer team and the amount of support and the amount of resources that they have around them. And we should, as everyone should, have a coach. That's my firm belief. But you've got to also choose your coach accordingly and know exactly what you want to get out of the coaching relationship. I think the last thing from my side is we have to own the conversation as leaders on how can we become better. How can we develop ourselves? I see a lot of people who call themselves leaders, but they don't invest in their own development. So unless you realize that this is what I need, you know, let's move away from the company must do this and that for me. As an individual, you know, what is it that you... What is your vision for your own career, for your own leadership journey, and what kind of support do you need? And then go out there and call on that support. So I would strongly say that it has to be owned by the leaders themselves instead of delegating it or abdicating it to the corporate and saying, well, my company does not develop me as a leader. Mm-hmm. You are the leader, not your company. Therefore, invest in yourself. In this age of technology, information is so readily available, you know, on social media, there's apps, there's online programs, there's access to the platform that we are on today, where on Twitter, I mean, I started following you in the leadership platform on Twitter, and it's amazing how much resources there are out there for us. Correct. As leaders, and that will be my key takeout.
Excellent takeout, but let me leave you with this thought. I think I touched on, shall we say, a gap in the coaching arena. off the field stuff. The other gap is this executive coaching world has evolved. It's become a science, and it's even internationally affiliated and everything else. I think what we're missing there now is the fact that at that executive level, that leader needs more than executive leadership coaching. They sometimes need just a sounding board. They sometimes need an advisor.
Yeah.
And they sometimes need a life coach.
Yes.
And then sometimes they need a trainer, one-on-one training on something. So the person sitting in front of them can't just be a refined coach, because coaching has certain methodology. Coach towards an outcome, blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. And when the outcome is achieved, stop. But hold on. There are challenges that they need to soundboard and test and have a thinking partner. That never changes. Just like a top athlete always needs a top coach. And even now, Djokovic, number two in the world, he was number one for so long. What's happening? He's trying to get, he calls it, I think, a mega coach. No, not a mega coach. It's a super coach. And he's looking at Andre Agassi, because he wants to go back to number one. Mm. Louis, final comments.
To build on that, Arjun, I think the more responsibilities a leader has, boy, looking back from old age, I would get all the nourishment I can. And we spoke this week of a quality young leader that you're busy with, Arjun. This guy's hungry to get all the help he possibly can. So I doubt
you. He's already polished.
I doubt a person's intelligence if he feels he's self-sufficient. How can you be in the modern world?
Well, we have a lot of unintelligent people out there then. Kabile Sulu, what a privilege to have you in the studio with us from Mondelez International, and we wish you well. You've been here a little while, but you were away, weren't you? Now you're back in this part of the world.
Yes, I spent some time in Amsterdam.
Mm. Well, welcome back. I think you can do a lot. You've got the right mindset. And, of course, Professor Shirley Zinn also joined us and left us a few minutes ago. And Louis Groenewald, the old man, and myself, Adrian Groenewald, over and out. That was great being with you. Look forward to our next Leadership Masterclass. Stay tuned for the Business Masterclass with Richard Angus and the team. Cheers, everyone. CliffCentral.com.